So anyway, we'll join in again. There was a question. What was the question that we left off with? The cliffhanger.
Should I do this now?
Your life.
What?
It was your life. It was the change, the switching point from when you noticed things in nature.
Yeah, that was part of it.
It was Jordy. It was Jordy's question.
Jordy's question.
Just get into calling.
Jordy's question about was it always stuff?
Was it always stuff? Yeah, okay, so I'll go there. I don't think that was, there was some nuance in that, but I think I'll get to the right point. I'm going to tell a little bit about my story and my spiritual formation. I grew up on a farm by New Sarepta, which is on the Highway 21 up to Edmonton. And it was a farm 3 miles west and 1 mile north of the Rolly View Road. And I am very much the youngest child of two people who were very much the youngest children in their family. Which means for somebody my age, I am one generation closer to the homesteaders who came at the turn of the 20th century than most people my age. Are you following? Am I making sense? What?
Generation-wise.
Generationally, I'm one generation closer, right, than most people my age. And so my grandparents were homesteaders, and my parents were the children of those homesteaders. And so part of that mystique of homesteading was very much a part of who I am. It wasn't until I was a teenager, Jordy, until I clued in that the name New Sarepta was laden with spiritual significance. Because Sarepta is a biblical reference from 1 Kings, the story of the widow at Zarephath. And I'll tell it for those of you who don't know it. The scoop was there was this prophet named Elijah, and the king of Israel at that time, his name was Ahab, and he had a very fine wife named Jezebel. Ahab believed that in order for nature to be productive, you had to apply the best technological manipulation in order for creation to be productive and provide you with food. It just so happened that the best technological production at that time came from some of the neighboring countries who were pretty good at agriculture, and they worshipped a god named Baal. And Baal was the god of fertility, of rain, of storms. And it was believed that the land became fertile when Baal copulated with his consort. That caused it to rain, that caused the cattle to be fertile and all those things. But Baal was a little bit lazy, and in order for Baal to get the idea, you had to model for Baal what Baal needed to do. And so therefore you needed to engage, if you were a good farmer and you were applying the latest techniques, in ritual prostitution. So you go to the Baal temple, engage in ritual prostitution, and that would sort of give Baal the idea of what Baal needed to do.
Convenient.
It was convenient, yeah.
For the king.
And so Elijah had a different model, a model of this god who is a free god and cannot be manipulated, and a god who desires to give generously. And Elijah essentially said to King Ahab, all right, if you want to apply the latest farming techniques, go ahead. But I suspect it's not going to rain for the next 3 years. But you go ahead and try that. And so Elijah was no longer very welcome, so he left town. And he went to a foreign country, to modern-day Lebanon, to the city of Sarepta. And there he encountered a poor widow who was gathering wood. And he said, why don't you give me something to eat? And she says, I'm gathering wood to make a fire so I can prepare the last meal for myself and my son, and then we're going to die because we're out of food. And Elijah said, trust me. And so she did. And so she provided a meal for him, made him a pancake, and they ate. And for the next 3 years, the tradition goes, that's the meal in her jar was never empty, and the oil in her jug never ran dry until the drought ended. And I think when my ancestors came to New Sarepta, or to this part of the world, it was part of their conviction that hospitality, generosity, and faith would keep them from hunger. And that was part of the ethic of the community. And it's why they named the place New Sarepta. I'm going to read a little excerpt from my my grandfather's younger brother. And he writes about the homesteading experience. Many of the immigrants had little or no money when they arrived, but they were able to borrow from the government to enable them to get started. At first, our family found shelter with a neighbor family, the Stoltzes, who had come the year previous. The first thing to do to get started was to chop down some trees, haul in the logs, and build a house. Ours was a one-room house connected under the same roof with a barn for cows and horses. A small connecting room served as a storm porch and utility room and furnished a common entrance to house and barn. The floors were of clay, so also was the open fireplace made of clay, and the chimney was clay bound with grass and wood. An iron crane held a cooking pot in the fireplace. The straw-thatched roof was very effective against the rain and made a good insulator against the cold. Fortunately, it never caught fire. In due time, the men, my father and older brothers, whipsawed some lumber, and we had a wooden floor and a ceiling. A second-hand cast-iron stove was substituted for the fireplace. All furniture was handmade. My dad was a blacksmith by trade and adept at carpentry. This came in good stead many a time in improvising, manufacturing, and repairing, not only for our immediate household, but people came from near and far to have their horses shod, their scythes and plowshares sharpened, and wagons repaired and retired. This furnished some income, which was very welcome. I well remember my mother weeping for joy when father brought home the first horse. He had paid $15 for it. It could pull the small plow or the wagon as needed. And before long, another horse was brought home, and that made a team, which was all that was needed for a small farm. Cows were also added from time to time to furnish the needed milk for the family and chickens to lay eggs and to hatch more chickens. Our meat diet in those early winters consisted mostly of rabbits and more rabbits. A large pit. Probably my father will not eat rabbit to this day. He's done with rabbits. He's had his quota. A large pit, probably 6 feet deep and 8 feet in diameter, was dug in the woods before freeze-up. Across this were laid thin poles and branches and grass to hide the opening. As the rabbits travel through the woods, they see the branches and decide to have a feed on their tender bark. They fall through the pit, from which they cannot escape. From 5 to 8 was considered an average night's catch. It was enough to feed a big family. Later, as the pigs multiplied and grew up, pork became the main meat diet. That and sauerkraut, together with potatoes, with very few variations, constituted our dinners. For breakfast, it was oatmeal. It was a year or two after we had arrived that my uncle Hoppy, my mother's brother, also arrived from Russia with his family. As they had no house to move into, they moved in with us. So there we were in a one-room house, 18 souls in all. Where did they all sleep? Well, I remember that we youngsters were lined up one next to another on a bed of hay with our heads to the wall. Two baskets suspended from the ceiling over the adults' homemade bedsteads served as cradles for the babies. Grass-filled bags made very satisfactory mattresses. In fact, I did not sleep on a custom-built mattress until I was about 15 years old. And so on and so on. So anyway, part of this mythology, this homesteader mythology, which you see at Ukrainian Village and Fort Edmonton and whatever, I grew up with and sort of part of the ideals that came out of that. And really, my people were very much focused on the production of food. That was morning, noon, and night. And they were focused on transforming the aspen prairie forest to agricultural land. And My parents would have grown up during the Great Depression, and true to the Widow of Zarephath story, they never went hungry, and they had plenty of opportunity to extend hospitality to strangers, particularly vagrant men who would come around. My paternal grandmother always said that she would always set an extra plate at the table because vagrant men would always manage to show up right around mealtime. It was just sort of how it was. My mother, during the war, after high school, went to Olds Agricultural College, where she learned home economics, you know, how to make cheese and butter and sausage and can and all that sort of stuff. My father was conscripted into the army, and he served a good part of that conscription in Jamaica. It was a tough posting, but somebody had to do it. Protect Jamaica from the Nazis.
You learned how to dance.
He learned how to dance and that sort of thing. But one of the stories he tells from Jamaica is he hated being on kitchen duty when they would have to take the garbage to the dump. Because they would load it on the back of a truck and they would take it to the local dump, and the orphan children would gather in the dump right underneath the truck where they dumped it to grab morsels of food as it came on. And the soldiers didn't leave a whole lot behind. And my father recalls one particularly heartbreaking day when a small boy managed to snag a really good morsel of food, only to have a bigger boy snatch it out of his hands. And that incident was a narrative that shaped his life. My father is 94 years old, and he's living in Bethany now, and he can only remember about 6 stories, and that's one of them. You know, it was a story that, you know, really shaped who he was. So a lot of, I grew up, although, you know, in a much more prosperous time, a lot of the values of homesteading, depression, and war were sort of inculcated in who I was. And so in terms of, you know, when did I become attuned to food and the land and this sort of thing, it started at a very early age. And part of the highest value was that it was communicated that the highest value in life is to feed people. And it doesn't matter if there are people gathered around your table or on the other side of the world. It's the most important thing you can do to feed people, and food comes from nature. You know, and that's why nature is precious, because it is the source of our food. And so I remember as a kid, like, you cannot come on our yard without getting fed. It didn't matter if you were the AGT repairman or the vet or a worker or whatever, you had to get fed. Like, and the greatest heresy was to come onto the yard packing your own lunch. Oh my goodness, what an insult. Like, you might as well, I would sooner have you pee in the middle of our floor than bring your own lunch on. You know, it was
although just... it wasn't expressed that way directly.
No. You know. And I remember when my parents were getting ready to leave the farm about 8 years ago, they started to downsize and they were having garage sales. And my parents decided that they would support Canadian Lutheran World Relief with the proceeds from these garage sales. And so when people came, they were always, of course, you came to the garage sale, you had to eat. So you were served coffee and with squares and buns and cheese and sausage and pickles. And there were big signs that all this food was going to feed the hungry, all the proceeds were going to feed the hungry. And of course, they charged exorbitant prices at their garage sale, and people were guilted into paying. It was very successful. And they had so much fun the first year, but they were running out of stuff that my dad spent the winter combing the New Sarepta garbage dump for lawnmowers and bicycles and whatever he could find. And he spent all winter fixing it up. And then they had another garage sale next spring. It was the greatest thing. It was also a way of dealing with inheritance. So my sisters and I, if we wanted some of our childhood toys and things, they all went up for sale in the garage sale, and the first one there got them.
Getting bidding wars.
So it was a way to deal with that.